But I do agree that Iran has good reason to be angry with the resolution, because it is an extension of the one rule for us and a different rule for you approach that's been taken by the AEA with respect to Iran from the beginning of this entire issue. Iran has the right to develop nuclear technology. Iran has complied with inspections. And what appears to be the case here is that Israel and the United States are together attempting to restrict Iran's development as a nuclear power.
After years of unprecedented inspections in its nuclear sites, the Iranian government seems to be outraged by the IAEA censure. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi pledged that such measures will never force Iran to back down from its rights. Meanwhile, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, says it is unfortunate that the IAEA is being exploited by an illegitimate regime. He demanded the agency put a stop to infiltration by Iran's enemies in its operations. As tensions between Iran and the agency soared this week, Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that it is disconnecting over 24 surveillance cameras that were installed in Iran beyond the country's IAEA obligations. Iran is also installing 2 new cascades of the IR-6 advanced centrifuges at its Natanz atomic fuel production facility. The Iranian atomic chief has said that Iran provided accurate answers to IAEA questions, but the agency lacks the will to declare Iran's answers convincing. Iran argues that the IAEA's focus on the country is discriminatory because it accounts for only a small amount of global nuclear activity and is undergoing hundreds of inspections per year. Negotiators from Iran and the P4+1 have held a year of intense negotiations to try to find a way to restore the JCPOA, but talks have stalled since March. The latest episode between Iran and the IAEA could further complicate the negotiations. Observers believe that the IAEA is pushing things in the direction favored by Israel.
Well, I believe that the resolution, which is primarily aimed at disrupting Iran's nuclear development program, is just part of a broader program of regional hegemony on the part of Israel. This program of regional hegemony has been supported by the United States in the past, and in fact, Israel was a prime mover in having the United States invade Iraq on the false pretense of weapons of mass destruction. I'm deeply concerned, and I must say I'm far more concerned than the IAEA could be about Iran's nuclear development program. I am much more concerned than that about the potential for Israel developing this issue via its supporters in the United States and via its own Israel lobby in America to bring the entire region into a potential state of war.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's in effect another example of a proxy war. In this instance, between the U.S. and Russia.
But But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone. Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now that establish beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbas and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultra-nationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. Pyongyang has frequently protested against Seoul and Washington's joint military exercises, calling them rehearsals for invasion, despite Washington's talk of diplomacy. The latest test marks the 18th time that North Korea has fired its missiles this year, including what the U.S. says was a failed intercontinental ballistic missile test on May 4th that exploded shortly after launch. Last month, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, said he would strengthen and develop his country's nuclear forces at the highest possible speed. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has failed to restart diplomatic talks with Pyongyang as tensions escalate. Former U.S. President Donald Trump attempted to court Pyongyang, but even though he met with the North Korean leader 3 times, he refused to relieve any of the sanctions in return for the several steps taken by Pyongyang toward denuclearization. That hampered further diplomacy between Pyongyang and Washington and prompted Kim to announce an end to a moratorium on the country's missile tests.
So it understands that a country that does not have a formidable arsenal can be subject to US attack because it's considered weak. So this is part of it. Well, if it wants to remain the Hermit Kingdom, it must look to be strong and unpredictable. And this is how it uses its military, the projection of its military force.
North Korea, which has been under rounds of crushing UN sanctions since 2006 over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, has ramped up its missile launches this year. The sanctions have led to rising levels of poverty and food insecurity. Despite the acknowledged food insecurity in North Korea, however, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Plan does not include an appeal for assistance to North Korea. A UN World Food Program report in 2019 concluded that 11 million of North Korea's 25 million people were undernourished, and one of every five children were stunted from lack of adequate nutrition. Last month, China and Russia vetoed a US-led push at the United Nations to toughen sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. China, the North's closest ally, and Russia, whose relations with the West have sharply deteriorated over its military operation in Ukraine, said they would have preferred a non-binding statement instead of a fresh resolution against Pyongyang. Beijing warned that sanctions would cause an escalation and humanitarian consequences for North Korea, which has been recently hit by COVID outbreak. Meanwhile, Russia said Washington is ignoring Pyongyang's appeals to stop hostile activity. During the past 16 years, the UN Security Council has steadily and unanimously ramped up sanctions to cut off funding for North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Since 2017, when the Council last stepped up sanctions on Pyongyang, China and Russia have been trying to ease sanctions on humanitarian grounds.
Because it's a coercive power. It doesn't want to treat another country on equal or humane terms because, I mean, it doesn't want to preserve the current leadership of North Korea. It wants regime change.
In particular, China's strategic overture to North Korea since the collapse of U.S.-North Korea diplomatic talks in 2019 has drawn the two countries closer. With tensions rising over the U.S.-China competition and a new South Korean conservative government that vows to take a harder line on North Korea and China, Beijing has more incentive to keep Pyongyang close.
This is this for is, a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to our program For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, today we are going to discuss an important issue about religious education. Religious education is an important concept and a very important aspect of Islam. And of course, religion is not only about praying, about fasting, about performing Hajj, but it's also about educating and nurturing human beings and creating a positive and instructive atmosphere whereby individuals who can live together peacefully, because human beings are social creatures and they cannot live separately from one another. They live together, they interact with one another, and therefore they should know how to deal with one another, how to interact with one another. In today's society, of course, a lot of emphasis is placed, unfortunately, on secular education. We know for sure that many countries around the world provide only secular education to their kids and to the people, to the schoolers, and to those who seek knowledge. For example, a child is pushed to strive for excellence in academics. A college or university education is a necessity. There is no doubt about it, both for boys and girls. Education is very much important. But the important question, the important point is that the significance of religious education for a balanced personality must not be overlooked. We need both secular education and, of course, religious education. I could say that education in and of itself is not secular. It is always religious. Because seeking knowledge, what kind of knowledge, whatever that kind of knowledge may be, it is essential. It is kind of collective obligation, whether it is about becoming a dentist or an engineer or someone. This may be termed as secular education, but it's not secular in its essence. Because Islam also emphasizes on acquiring these skills, as long as there is a need for any skill in the society, we have to try to acquire those skills, learn them, and of course help our society. But religious education, when we talk about religious education in its specific meaning, we mean education based on Islamic standards, religious values, Islamic doctrines. In modern world, we see that the world in which we are living is producing a generation that knows a lot, but is, of course, greatly deficient in moral and spiritual values. Today's human beings have conquered the space. They have conquered even some planets. For example, they have gone to the moon and they have set foot. They have gone to the Mars. At least they have sent satellites to those places, and they have discovered many, many planets and stars and Milky Ways. They have made remarkable achievements in when it comes to discovering the space. But they have marginalized, sidelined, or overlooked moral and spiritual values to a large extent.
Changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
For example, in modern time we see that children are brought up without any understanding of religion, without any understanding of moral values and moral doctrines. But according to Islam, parents have been given the noble duty of guiding the future generation. It is their task to ensure that their children get a sound religious education. Obviously, nurturing is an important duty of parents. Nurturing. Providing religious education is an important responsibility of parents. In this, of course, they are carrying the work of the prophets who guided the people. What was the responsibility of the prophets? The prophet's responsibility was also to guide human beings to the right path, to provide religious education. That was their duty. And of course, it's also the duty of the parents. And that's why I'm saying that parents are carrying on the work of the prophets. Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara wa qudaha an-nasu wal hijara. O you who believe, save yourselves and your families from a fire whose fuel is man and stones. Chapter 66, verse 6. Now, this is a warning given to the families, to the parents especially, and to those who believe that it is your responsibility to protect not only yourselves, but also your families. And to protect from what? Protect from hellfire. Okay. Now, let's remember that nurturing begins right from the time of conception, when a woman conceives. And then nurturing continues until a child's character and personality is shaped. Therefore, it is important for a mother, for a father, what the mother eats and what the father brings home, what the mother sees and what she does not see, and who she interacts with. She should purify her soul, she should purify her inner self, she should avoid eating haram morsel of food. A morsel of haram food will definitely destroy one's efforts to educate his or her child according to Islamic and religious values and doctrines. What the father brings home is very important. It should be something halal, something pure, something allowable. If he brings, God forbid, something which is haram, for example, if he has earned something by way of haram means and he brings it home and gives it to his children, it will have a lasting impact on his family and on his children. I said that whatever efforts he makes, if he brings something haram for his family to consume, all his efforts to educate his children according to Islamic values and doctrines will be null and void. What exactly is meant by religious education? We shall discuss this with some evidence, with some elements of religious education in the following episode. Obviously, the goal of religious education is to introduce and train good human beings and introduce good human beings to the society. And inshallah, we will discuss these in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. Oh, oh, oh. Your love is all I need.
Love is all I need.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., Representative Tom Rice is bracing for a tough runoff election against a Trump-backed challenger following Tuesday's primary. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Maya King and Jonathan Martin. The piece is titled Days Before His South Carolina Primary, a GOP congressman who voted to impeach Trump stands by his vote. Stay with us for more. Tom Rice, the South Carolina congressman who was one of 10 House Republicans to vote to impeach President Donald Trump after the January 6 attacks, has a catch-all term to describe the former president's crusade against him: Trump's very presidential traveling revenge circus. Donald Trump has made unseating Tom Rice, a five-term congressman, one of his top priorities in the state's primary elections this Tuesday, 14th of June. He threw his support in the Republican primary for Tom Rice's seat behind State Representative Russell Fry, calling into a rally to Mr. Fry this week and describing Tom Rice as a backstabbing rhino, the acronym for Republican in name only, a conservative slur. He lifted up his hand and that was the end of his political career, or we hope it was, Donald Trump said of Tom Rice's vote to impeach him. In a 35-minute interview on Friday, 10th of June, alongside his wife, Renzi, after a barbecue luncheon campaign event, Tom Rice sounded every bit like a man in the fight for his political life. His campaign is not counting on an outright win against Mr. Fry, but is instead bracing for a tough runoff with him. But while some, after crossing Donald Trump, have tried to salvage their political careers by walking back their comments or retiring from Congress altogether, Tom Rice has doubled down. To me, his gross failure, his inexcusable failure, was when it started, Tom Rice said of the January 6 riot. He watched it happen. He reveled in it. And he took no action to stop it. I think he had a duty to try to stop it, and he failed in that duty. Tom Rice, a pro-business conservative and self-proclaimed Chamber of Commerce Republican, helped craft Donald Trump's sweeping new tax code in 2017. 5 years after those reforms and 17 months after the 6th of January attacks, he argued that the former president had overstayed his welcome in the Republican Party. He's the past, Tom Rice said of Donald Trump. I hope he doesn't run again, and I think if he does run again, he hurts the Republican Party. We desperately need somebody who's going to bring people together, and he is not that guy. Mr. Rice said that the 6th of January primetime hearing on Thursday night, which featured footage of the Capitol riots and incriminating testimony from close Donald Trump associates, puts an exclamation point on what we did, referring to the 10 House Republicans who backed Donald Trump's impeachment. In the days after the riot at the Capitol, Mr. Rice said he considered voting to impeach Donald Trump and spent that Saturday and Sunday in his home congressional district, reading the dozens of stories he had asked his staff to send him about the president's whereabouts on 6th of January 2021. As he learned of the president's refusal to stop the attack, he became incensed. When it came time for his vote, he said he had zero question in my mind about whether Donald Trump should be held accountable. I did it then, Tom Rice said, and I will do it tomorrow, and I'll do it the next day or the day after that. I have a duty to uphold the Constitution, and that is exactly what I did. Mr. Rice did not vote to certify the election, however, saying he had become concerned about ballot discrepancies in Pennsylvania that were outlined in a letter to House Republican leadership. During a House Republican meeting 1 month after the Capitol riots, he defended Liz Cheney for her vote to impeach Donald Trump and criticized Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, for his continued embrace of the former president, according to audio from the exchange. Kevin McCarthy went to Mar-a-Lago this weekend, shook his hand, took a picture, and set up TrumpMajority.com. "Personally, I find that offensive," Mr. Rice said at the time. In the months following the vote, Tom Rice has been made a pariah among those in Donald Trump's circle, as has his wife. "I don't feel like I fit in with that group anymore," Tom Rice's wife said on Friday, referring to the Republican base. Donald Trump's efforts to sway Republican primary voters and disparage Tom Rice have left the congressman both frustrated and puzzled. He has come to view them as a political stunt. "Bring on the circus," Tom Rice said of Mr. Trump's involvement in the primary. "You know, some people are afraid of clowns. I'm not afraid of clowns."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being sensitive on performing good and evil. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being sensitive on performing good and evil. When we look at the Islamic teachings and when we see if someone wants to gain the perfection in his life, if someone wants to have the self-purification, and if someone needs or wants to have the best development in his life, it is necessary to be sensitive on performing good and evil. In both cases, we need to show the sensitivity that we need to have. Why is it necessary? It is because when we are not sensitive towards the evil or towards the good, there is the time where people lose their ethical virtues, where the people lose their nobility, where they lose the character that they must have. And this is because when they do not show sensitivity towards the performing the good and evil. When we talk about performing good, like being sensitive on good, for example, you know, when we see our kids performing something good, maybe they're not disturbing us, we must encourage them. We must basically encourage them for what they are doing. We must declare it as a good performance. For example, when we see our kids are not lying, we must appreciate them for such thing that they're not lying. When we see our kids, when there is a fight, they're not fighting, they're avoiding it. They're coming towards the dialogue. They are avoiding any kind of act that can lead to a higher consequences. And this is something which is good. We must appreciate them. And similarly, we must appreciate everyone in the society for being good. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of being sensitive on good and evil in the path of perfection. And we said that it is necessary to show this sensitivity when someone performs good action. And by this, we mean that when someone is performing good, he is having a good deeds. Therefore, we must appreciate them. We must appreciate the good things in the society. This is what we generally do not do. We are sensitive on the evil sometimes, but sometimes we are not. For example, if there is something, an evil action, which we see now in today's world, unfortunately, in this secular life that we have, especially in the West, if someone is performing something, generally people say, do not get involved, or, you know, even they avoid calling police. Or informing police if someone is performing or committing a crime. Why? Because we do not want to get involved. But if we show sensitivity towards the crime, and if everyone in the society becomes sensitive on the evil deeds and evil actions, then obviously those who have the habit of performing evil, they will avoid performing it. They will stop from performing the evil. Why? Because they know that if they show such a action from themselves, people will react on that. And this is something which they have the fear of. Therefore, this is also another idea that if those who have the habit of performing evil, if they want to make or normalize the evil, they take away the sensitivity of something being evil from the society. Therefore, we do show sensitivity on the things that are bad. But on the other hand, we must show some sensitivity on the good things, and we must appreciate people. For example, if someone is helping someone, if someone is, you know, by any means being noble, helping, and he speaks in a good manner, we must appreciate so that he can continue and other people can also learn from him how to be a good person. Therefore, in order to get the perfection, in order to have the self-development, it is necessary to show some sensitivity on goodness and the evil, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
in the limelight.
It turns out that U.S. inflation is a boon for monopolies, for it gives them cover to flash their pricing power, says Jim Hightower, writer, in an article published under the heading, Blame American Profit-Hungry Corporations Milking Consumers for Inflation. Stay tuned for more. The problem is with so-called free market. It's largely controlled by monopolies, which are free to inflate prices just because they can, without worrying that consumers will be able to flee to cheaper sellers. In turn, this market punch lets the non-competitive gougers gleefully extract unwarranted monopoly profits. It's a phenomenon that corporatists euphemistically label pricing power. This economy-wide milking of consumers by tightly consolidated industries is the unbridled force propelling today's surging price hikes in the U.S. Brand name corporations claim they are being forced to mark up price tags just to cover rising costs for raw materials, labor, transportation, etc. But in a competitive marketplace, they'd have to eat much of those increases by taking a bit less in profits. The giants have been stockpiling record profits for years, so they could easily weather a downtick. Instead, they are raising prices not simply to maintain exorbitant profits, but to squeeze even greater profits from hard-hit consumers. It's a game of corporate greed that socks America's economy. Monopolies cynically exploit the public's worry about inflation to create more inflation. Consider diapers, a necessity for many families. As corporate watchdog Jude Legum reported, the huge consumer product seller Procter & Gamble Co. announced a year ago that COVID-19-driven production costs were forcing it to raise the price for its Pampers brand. At the same time, it had just posted a quarterly profit of $3.8 billion, so P&G could easily have absorbed a temporary rise in its cost. But instead of holding the price to ease their consumers' economic pain, the conglomerate used a global health crisis to justify upping diaper prices. 6 months later, P&G's quarterly profit topped $5 billion. But instead of holding the price to ease their customers' economic pain, the conglomerate used the global health crisis to justify upping diaper prices. 6 months later, P&G's quarterly profit topped $5 billion. And in that same quarter, P&G spent $3 billion to buy back shares of its own stock, a Wall Street manipulation that artificially bloats the wealth of top execs and other big shareholders. In some, P&G used the excuse of inflation to inflate the prices of diapers, then used the extra money it extracted from families to inflate the value of its stock in a ploy to further enrich its biggest shareholders. And why wouldn't savvy consumers switch from Pampers to Huggies, the brand sold by Kimberly-Clark, P&G's main competitor? Because co-monopolies Kimberly-Clark goosed up its prices at the same time. And get this, the two companies control 80% of the global disposable diaper market. Welcome to the monopoly merry-go-round. Almost all CEOs of big corporations are playing this trick inflation blame game. Pop publicly, they moan that the pandemic is slamming their poor corporations with factory shutdowns, supply chain delays, labor shortages, wage hikes, and other increased costs. But wait, inside their boardrooms, executives are high-fiving each other and pocketing bonuses. What's going on? It turns out that inflation is a boon for monopolies, for it gives them cover to flash their pricing power. The trick is that these giants are in non-competitive markets operating as monopolies, so they can set higher prices, mug you and the people of the U.S. and scamper away with a record-busting share of America's total economic output. In 2019, for example, before the pandemic hit, big U.S. corporations hauled in roughly $1 trillion in profits. In 2021, during the pandemic, they grabbed more than $1.7 trillion. Antitrust analyst Matt Stoller finds that this huge profit jump accounts for 60% of the inflation now slapping U.S. families. Take Rodney McMullen, CEO of the supermarket Goliath Kroger. He gloated last summer that a little bit of inflation is always good in our business, adding that we've been very comfortable with our ability to pass on price increases to consumers, as he said. Comfortable indeed. Last year, Kroger used its monopoly pricing power to reap record profits. Then it spent $1.5 billion of those gains not to benefit consumers or workers, but to buy back its own stock, a scam that gives more money to top executives and big shareholders. Or take fast food purveyor McDonald's. It gushed to its shareholders that 2021 had been a banner year. Executives bragged that despite the supply disruptions of the pandemic and higher costs for meat and labor, they used the chain's pricing power to up the prices, thus increasing corporate profits by a stunning 59% over the previous year. And the party goes on. We are going to have the best growth we've ever had this year. The Wall Street banking titan, Jamie Dimon, exulted at the start of 2022. Hocus pocus, this is how the rich get richer and inequality happens across the United States of America.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. Let me refer to some of the points mentioned in Imam Khomeini's testament, which is full of useful meaning. The first point is that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi insisted in his testament on the fact that the Islamic revolution is a divine revolution. The fact that this revolution belongs to the general public is one of the best tenets of the revolution. In this regard, there is no discrimination in favor of a particular social class. The second point is about a prophecy in the Imam's testament that the revolution would spread to other places and it will liberate the Muslim world from the clutches of colonialists. That was a prediction that our magnanimous Imam had made. When we look at the reality on the ground today, we see that his prediction has been fulfilled. Imam Khomeini's opinion, the revolution, unlike other revolutions, was not to be propagated by sowing the seeds of discord in other countries or by deploying military forces or by spreading terrorism. Spreading the revolution among other nations is to be realized through setting an example on the part of the Islamic Republic.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In other words, the Iranian nation should help the Islamic Republic reach a point and a position that when other nations look to it, they are filled with enthusiasm and are encouraged to follow in its footsteps. Such an initiative is to occur through propagating Islamic teachings, through public support of the oppressed groups within the Muslim world, and through supporting the oppressed nations that have been downtrodden by the oppressive, arrogant powers. That is what we mean by the spreading of Islamic rule, and it has already begun. Today, other nations throughout the world have fixed their attention on the Iranian nation. They're inspired and motivated by our nation. Today, the anti-domination principles of the Iranian nation have spread to all parts of the Muslim world. If you travel to different Muslim countries, you will notice that their people have a high opinion of your beliefs, motives, and aspirations, regardless of their governments.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation. But this time, it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by a quarter of 1% next month, most likely a half of 1% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I have also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO.
ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A daily occurrence in Donetsk, a building going up in smoke. It was hit by Ukrainian shelling. This time it's an industrial warehouse, but targets like this are not usual.
Now, working as a journalist here, whenever I have nothing else planned, I simply follow the incoming here in Donetsk. And when I arrived at the fifth school that had been hit in as many days, the penny started to drop. And I asked my translator, a local woman with her two-year-old child herself, does the Ukrainian army intentionally shell schools? She replied as if it was the most normal thing in the world. Well, yes, they've been doing it for the last 8 years.
School 5, 13, 22, 33, 57, 106, 114, 116. There are dozens more. So why is Ukraine purposefully targeting schools? In 2014, when the shelling began, former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko made this famous speech.
Because we will have our jobs and they will not. We will have our pensions and they will not. We will have care for our children, people and retirees and they will not. Our children will go to schools and kindergartens and theirs will hole up in the basements because they are not able to do a thing. This is exactly how we will win this war.
Six schools were hit only this week. They would like to create a humanitarian crisis here, so as many of us leave as possible. They think that this is their land and the Russian-speaking people are foreigners. They want us to leave to Russia. That's why they shell civilians here every day.
In 2014, School 57 was hit on the exact day the students returned for the school year. 10 people were killed.
Now, for obvious reasons, for the last